now have a new challenge, perhaps the most monumental in recorded history. The opportunity to investigate a phenomenon that could change our destiny. A look at ourselves 1,000 years in the future.
We're going to examine and perhaps question some widely held theories of what may have happened to this Earth of ours. We're going to investigate some strange and bizarre events in the present. Unbelievable happenings as fresh as today's headlines. And more important, perhaps, we're going to take a searching and scientific look into the future. We're reaching more and more out into space. Perhaps as we may learn, someone, something, somewhere in space is reaching out to us.
Who the visitors are, where they're from, and what they want is unknown.
Bigfoot was attracting national attention and was now rapidly becoming the most intriguing mystery on the North American continent. Scientists and photography experts have examined the individual frames of this film and have come to the conclusion that the film and the creature are authentic.
Telepathy, psychokinesis, Bigfoot and black masses, UFOs and Atlantis, Kirlian photography, cloning, and cryonics. These subjects all have one thing indisputably in common. People want to know more about them. The mankind's future on Earth and beyond.
Welcome to After Dark Radio with your host, Brian Alvarez.
How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on After Dark Radio, January 16, 2016. After Dark Radio here on the Dark Matter Digital Network every Sunday night, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern. You can hear the Dark Matter Digital Network live and free on TuneIn Radio. You can head to darkmatterdigitalnetwork.com, afterdarkradioshow.com. If you're listening on replay, you are missing out if you don't hear this show live on Sunday night. Very exciting show for you here tonight. Tom Powell is going to be our guest. He is the author of Edges of Science. A couple of months ago, I went to the Sasquatch Summit in Ocean Shores, Washington, and there was a fella, Tom Powell, who was getting ready to do a presentation about Sasquatch, and I had seen him. He was selling his book, Edges of Science. He was also selling Bigfoot casts, Bigfoot tracks. And I asked somebody before he went on stage, what can you tell me about this Tom Powell fella? And the answer I got, as we'll talk about tonight, is he is a very controversial guy, and he has a lot of ideas that make other Bigfoot researchers nervous. And I thought, all right, here we go. And in fact, he looks at the paranormal aspect of Sasquatch. Now, some of you may be thinking, how is this the edges of science if he's looking at the paranormal aspect? Shouldn't science be looking at the possibility that this is an animal? Well, in fact, Tom Powell, for years, went out looking for Bigfoot, doing all of the same things that all of the other Bigfoot researchers did. He howled, he knocked on wood, he had all of the trail cams, and not only did he get nothing, but a lot of really weird things happened to him, which caused him to think, you know what, if we're going to look at this in a scientific manner, we need to open up our minds and think about the possibility that maybe there is a paranormal aspect to this. Stuff like telepathy, stuff like Bigfoot and UFOs being together in the same place. Maybe Bigfoot is an extraterrestrial. We're going to talk about all of that with Tom Powell on the show tonight, and I am very excited about that. I've been wanting to get him on the show for a long time, and just found out actually a couple of days ago that he was going to be on. And so I grabbed his book, vociferously read it from cover to cover. It's great. So check it out. Edges of Science. Tom Powell is going to be our guest on the program here today. It's a doubleheader. After Dark Radio, followed by Carl Stern's Dragon King Dark tonight here on the Dark Matter Digital Network. We did this last week and it was a big hit. And so we're going to be doing it again. The Carl Stern Dragon King Dark Show is available at AfterDarkRadioShow.com every week. Episode 3 is up right now, where Carl talks about a local legend, the story of Aunt Jenny Johnson. If you've not heard that yet, if you've not grabbed it off AfterDarkRadioShow.com, you can hear it tonight on the Dark Matter Digital Network, as we are in fact doing this big double header, After Dark Radio, followed by Dragon King Dark. Hopefully we do this every week because we got a lot of great feedback about it. People seem to really enjoy it. And so once again tonight, when this show goes off the air, Carl Stern will be on talking Aunt Jenny Johnson here on the Dark Matter Digital Network. Want to add that for those of you that are listening via Downcast or some sort of after-the-fact podcast airing of this show, MP3 download, we are right now exclusively hosting these at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. I know a lot of people from the wrestling website have asked. I will eventually put those up there in the archives, but for now, I want to get people in the habit of going to AfterDarkRadioShow.com. So right now, if you do not listen to the live show, or you want to grab the replay afterwards, you got to get it at the After Dark website, AfterDarkRadioShow.com. It's brand new. It's been revamped. We've got news, we've got shows, and we've got columns. Mark Howes has got a great new column up there today. He's talking about quantum weirdness. I'm going to read the first paragraph here, and of course, if you want more, it is up right now absolutely free at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. As the old thought experiment goes, if a tree falls in a forest when nobody is around to hear it, does it make a sound? Well, turns out that the tree never actually fell at all. It was only when a person next showed up that the tree decided that it had fallen down, and so that is what the person sees. Confused? You should be. Welcome to the wacky world of quantum mechanics, where leading physicist Richard Feynman claims, if you think you understand quantum mechanics, you don't understand quantum mechanics. That column is up right now by Mark Howes on the front page of AfterDarkRadioShow.com, so head up there and check that out. A couple of news notes here for today before we go to Tom Powell. This story in the TimesColonist.com. TimesColonist.com. Dave Obey writing about a photograph of a mermaid that was taken almost 50 years ago. And I always love a story that I've never heard of before that's been around for a long, long time. And this is one of them. I'll read some of this here, and you can go up and Google Maine Island Mermaid. And that's M-A-Y-N-E, Maine Island, M-A-Y-N-E, Maine Island Mermaid. And you will see a photograph of this. Now, how many times have you heard, oh, if you Google this, you can see this photograph that somebody says that they took of a Sasquatch or a UFO or an alien or whatever. And you go up there and it is the blurriest, most out of focus blob squatch, as Lauren Coleman calls them, that you've ever seen. Well, this one is not. This is absolutely for sure a blonde woman with a fishtail sitting on the side of an island. It's black and white, but it's pretty clear. And obviously, as we'll get going here, it is fully believed that what it was a woman who decided that she was going to make a mermaid tail and then sit outside and, I guess, wave at the fairy or hold onto a fish as the fairy floated by. And to this day, nobody has any idea who it was. Unless, of course, you believe that it was actually a mermaid. It says here, these days, the sight of a mermaid LOLing about on Main Island in full view of ferries passing by would be captured a few hundred different ways on social media. By the time any of the ferries cleared active pass, the whole world would know about the woman dressed as the mermaid. By the time the ferries reached a terminal, however, nobody would care anymore. It was not like that. In June of 1967, a mermaid on Main Island was seen by a few people, but captured the imaginations of many others. They're still talking about it today. The creature was seen in the early evening by passengers on ferries close to the west entrance to Active Pass. The Daily Colonist reported on the sighting the next day and included a photograph that it said had been taken by George Harrison of Sioux City, Iowa. Several witnesses said the mermaid had a large fish, apparently a coho salmon, and one swore she had taken a bite out of it, said the Colonist on June 13, 1967. Long silver blonde hair and topless condition were generally agreed upon. The next day, the Colonist referred to her as a dimpled mermaid and said she had the lower body of a fish or a porpoise. The newspaper said she had been at Helen Point on the northwest corner of Main Island and had been seen eating a large salmon. And is noted, M-A-Y-N-E, Main Island Mermaid, you can Google it and see a photograph for yourself. And as the article here concludes, it is believed it is just a hoax. Some woman who decided that she was going to make a mermaid outfit for the lower half of her body and sit out there and wave at folks on the ferry. And it says here, every now and then we get queries about the mermaid sighting, usually from people who are desperate to believe it was real. This year, we are told the dimpled damsel of the deep will be included in a new book on the supernatural. Odds are the woman on Helen Point that evening did not think that a long blonde wig and a slimy green tail would earn her a spot of honor in the history of gullibility. But who knows? The story has legs, even though the mermaid did not. Our local mermaid wannabe would probably be in her 60s or 70s by now. Who was she? Is she still around? The alleged mermaid never came forward to say who she was. This here, from Jesse Emspach, is written article. Some of you may remember the famous WOW signal from August 15, 1977. Says here the famous WOW signal might have been from comets, not from aliens. On August 15, 1977, radio astronomers using the Big Ear radio telescope at Ohio State University picked up a powerful signal from space. Some believe it was our first interception of an alien broadcast. Now it seems something closer to home may have been the source, a pair of passing comets. The signal, known as the WOW signal, after a note scribbled by astronomer Jerry Emmon, who detected it, came through at 1420 megahertz, corresponding to a wavelength of 21 centimeters. Searchers for extraterrestrial transmissions have long considered it an auspicious place to look, as it is one of the main frequencies at which atoms of hydrogen, the most common element in the universe, absorb and emit energy. What's more, this frequency easily penetrates the atmosphere, but in the 40 years since the WOW signal was detected, we have never heard anything like it again. Analysis of the signal ruled out a satellite, and a reflected signal from the Earth's surface is unlikely because regulations forbid transmission in that frequency range. The signal's intensity rose and fell over the course of 72 seconds, which is the length of time that the Big Ear could keep an object in its field of view due to the rotation of the Earth. That meant it was clearly coming from space. So what was it? Antonio Paris, a professor of astronomy at St. Petersburg College in Florida, thinks the signal might have come from one or more passing comets. He points the finger at two suspects called 266P Christensen and P2008Y2. He says, I came across the idea when I was in my car driving and wondered if a planetary body moving fast enough could be the source. To test his idea, he proposes looking in the same region of space when the comets are back. Comet 266P will transit the region first on 25 January 2017, so that's actually just a year from now, and P2008 on 7 January 2018. An analysis of the hydrogen signal of the comets could reveal if he is correct. So we may soon know the answer to the mystery of the WOW signal, or maybe we won't. What will it mean if these comets are not responsible? It's going to be very interesting. We'll find out in 1 and 2 years, respectively. This story here is awesome. I have long since been following the story of the missing Malaysia Airlines MH370. And the BBC here reports, search teams looking for the missing Malaysia Airlines MH370 think they have stumbled across a 19th century shipwreck. Underwater sonar equipment turned up a strange object more than 2 miles beneath the waves just before Christmas. Earlier this month, they sent down an unmanned submarine to take a picture. Experts at the Western Australian Museum think it is a 19th century ship made of metal. So to clarify, they have now been looking for MH370 for almost 2 years. They cannot find this missing airplane, but they found two shipwrecks. Just amazing to think about. In a moment, Tom Powell is going to be joining us. He is the author of Edges of Science, which is available at Amazon.com. You can grab a hard copy. You can grab a Kindle edition. I believe the Kindle edition is only $6. Tom Powell, it says here, made just about every mistake possible in his journey through paranormal investigation, except one. At least he remembered to write it all down. Eventually, he figures it out, and what began as a clumsy two-step becomes a graceful ballet. Read his thoughts and experiences along the way and benefit from the years Tom invested in figuring out what is really going on at the edges of science. Tom Powell, our guest here in just a moment. After Dark Radio, here on the Dark Matter Digital Network. We are back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here. After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Digital Network. Very happy today to be joined by Tom Powell, author of a number of books, including Edges of Science, which you can check out at Amazon.com. If you've got Kindle Unlimited, you can read it for free. There is a paper copy available. You can just grab the Kindle edition and buy that. Many other options as well. And Tom, how are you doing today?
Great. Thanks for having me on.
Tom, I saw you at the Sasquatch Summit.
Oh.
Oh, yes.
Right.
Yes, it was awesome. And
Johnny's thing.
Yes. And before you went on stage, I was talking to, I don't remember who, and maybe I shouldn't even say anyway, but I said, what can you tell me about Tom's presentation he's going to do here? And the answer was something to the effect of, it's very controversial.
It sounds like Dave Grant's words, but I won't name names.
That's right. That's right. They said he says some things that make other researchers uncomfortable. And I thought, this is the man for me here.
All right.
And it was a great presentation. And before we get into everything else here, I just want you to tell everybody a little bit about yourself. I know that you're a teacher. You talk about the science fair, one of the chapters in Edges of Science. And I guess we'll just start with that, and I guess a little bit about how you got into this whole Bigfoot research deal.
Well, I was a Portland city liver, and I taught school, and, you know, everything was fine. I was sort of a kayaker and outdoorsman in the free time. But then I moved to Clackamas County, gave up the city, moved to the country. Back in the time when, you know, rural property was probably more available than it is today. But so I, you know, sort of did the forge a home out of the wilderness thing and really loved it. But I also found that I moved into this area where, you know, they gave serious consideration to the Bigfoot thing. And as a science teacher, that blew my mind because, you know, I actually, truth be told, I used it as a topic of scientific ridicule, and, you know, I thought I was pretty cool. But then these people around me are like, no, we have this around us. And so I sort of said, well, in a good-natured way, prove it. Let's go. Let's show me this. And I expected to debunk things in short order. But I will say that it definitely set me on my ear, not just because, you know, several sources were saying it, but then I got busy and tried to do my own sets of experiments and got actually surprising results. Never the eyeball sighting, there's Mr. Squatch and all of this, but, you know, very intriguing things happened, which would take a long time to explain, but it really sort of changed my thinking. So I got involved in the Sasquatch game for a long time and, you know, continued to sort of be surprised by the fact that, you know, trail cams don't work and that the things are smarter than you think they are. But, you know, it just didn't seem imaginary, even though the results were pretty befuddling. So I kept with it, and one thing led to another. Once I started bringing in other sort of paranormal elements, it all started to make sense. So that was the idea with Edges of Science, is that if you want to understand, you know, the Sasquatch phenomenon specifically, then the key might just be to bringing in some of these other paranormal elements and seeing how similar the research in these other areas is and how it all points in several or maybe even just a few key directions.
I remember before your talk, you were selling stuff. You had a booth there, and I grabbed a couple of prints, the Sasquatch prints, and I saw your book there.
Trackcast.
That's right. That's right, Trackcast. And I saw your book, and I didn't buy it at the moment. And then I went and I sat down, and I had been told Tom here he's going to be discussing the paranormal aspects of Bigfoot. It's very very controversial. And I got to tell you, when they told me that, I was like, okay, well, this is going to be very wacky. I can't wait.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time you were done, I went over and I bought your book immediately. I never really thought a lot about the paranormal aspect of Bigfoot. And when I did, it was kind of like what I'm sure a lot of Bigfoot researchers would say, which is it's crazy enough to be looking for an animal, an ape, but you bring in the paranormal aspect, and now you're like really talking about the edges of science, so to speak. But I liked the idea that you essentially concluded that all this stuff that we've been doing, looking for an ape, it ain't working.
Right.
And it's weird enough as it is, so if we're going to look at this from a scientific perspective, we have to open our minds to all sorts of different scenarios, and that includes the paranormal. And
right.
I thought it was...
But it also includes doing a little bit of reading about historical figures because, you know, none of the smack I'm talking is all that new. Charles Fort was saying similar things back in the 30s. 1930s. Now, you know, there were some... He was off in certain ways, but, you know, I think we have a lot more scientific underpinnings now to draw from, obviously, with almost 100 years. But it's amazing how these early guys had it figured out, Charles Fort and John Keel in the 60s, Jim Brandon and Ted Holliday was doing stuff with, like, Loch Ness Monster. And, you know, I laughed at that one, too, and until I realized, boy, if you don't live there, you have no idea what's really going on. And sometimes they're there and sometimes they're not. And it's exactly the way the whole Sasky game goes for us out here in the Pacific Northwest. You know, they're very definitely there at certain times, and the rest of the times they are somewhere else. So you got to figure this out, and how does that all work, and is it a zoological question or is it a physics question? It just goes on and on.
Now, before you moved out into a more rural area, you said that when people started talking about Bigfoot, it was a chance for you to ridicule them.
Sure, sure, because I was a science teacher. And
sure.
Here's a thing that just doesn't live up to the standards of science. It's a bunch of people who saw something run across the road, and, you know, they're on their way home from the bar, so that disqualifies them, and so on and so forth. But once I found that they weren't all, you know, drunks heading home at 2 a.m., and I've even talked to a few who said, well, maybe I was a little drunk, but I wasn't that drunk. I know what I saw. You know, and so it's just kind of comical in a way that some of the sources that you're sort of forced to scientifically take on, you know, on the one hand have zero credibility, but on the other hand have no reason to lie to you, their neighbor.
Now, even before you moved out there, I mean, have you lived in Oregon your whole life, like the Portland area?
No, I'm an Ohio boy.
I'm from
the outer Cleveland area. And turns out, you know, I was a scout when I was a kid, and boy, we'd go out to these areas around Punderson State Park, Ashtabula County. Well, and I was back there 10 years ago and visited these guys, and they said, oh, we got these great areas for Sasquatch. And I was blown away because the places they took me were the same places I used to go as a kid. We weren't, you know, doing Sasquatch stuff, but that's where you start to wonder whether there isn't a connection there that runs deeper than your actual consciousness.
Now, even before you moved out there, and you were in Ohio, and then later you came to the Northwest, I mean, obviously, as you mentioned, you'd heard of Bigfoot when you were a kid, and you had to have run across somebody who told you, Tom, I'm telling you, I saw something.
in Ohio, that's for sure.
No, but I mean out here.
Not only in Ohio, but even not in the years I lived in Oregon and had an outdoor job at this, you know, environmental education place. Only when I moved to the country did people start, you know, changing my thinking about what I was sure of. What's interesting is when I first moved to Oregon, I had this environmental job at this center, and you know what? Every once in a while, some group of kids in some cabin would just absolutely go off. And we'd go running down there, seeing what all thing about, well, one of these is like, you know, environmental campers had seen some face in their window. If I knew then what I knew now, what I know now, I would have realized that, you know, they really did see something. We were in the prime area, and we were there for long enough, and with all these kids there, things were happening, and we just dismissed it. We just thought, these silly kids, they're imagining things. But knowing what I know now, things actually happened very rarely, but very definitely, you know, every once in a great while, there would be this huge turmoil down in this one area where all these kids were saying they saw something and so on and so forth.
Now, you write about in Edges of Science, you do these science fairs, obviously. You teach 8th grade astrophysics, I believe it's called right now.
Correct.
Yes.
You know, old school astronomy.
That's right. And you, at one point, had a mom come up to you,
mm-hmm.
and she had these wonderful children. It was a great family. And I guess once a year you do the UFO lesson right before Christmas break when all the kids are out of their minds. And she came up to you afterwards and she said, you know, I have had an experience. And she was a very famous abductee, although we don't know who she is really because she doesn't want anyone to know who she
right.
is.
Right. She used a nom de plume, you know, because so even today people need to protect their reputation even... You know, they have too much to risk by coming public as witnesses.
Now, the only reason that you knew this was because she found out that you did this lesson. So
mm-hmm.
before we talk about her, do you think now, looking back, that when you had that job, do you think that there were other people that worked with you that maybe had seen or experienced something and they just didn't want to tell anybody about it?
Well, I don't know about people I worked with, but people in the community. And I think I sort of became a lightning rod for stuff because I embraced the paranormal and the kids, you know, and I was taking kind of a big professional risk because the kids could have easily gone home and fanned the flames of parental indignation that the science teacher would engage the kids on these, you know, fanciful topics. But instead, much to my surprise, it worked the other way. People came to me and said, hey, you want stories? I got stories. And my kid tells me that you're into this, blah, blah, blah. I had like an Indian family, like American Indian, the kid, you know, and so I used that interaction with this American Indian family that I met through a kid of American Indian descent who was in my class, and boy, they gave me enough material that's what Shady Neighbors came from. By the way, you did a great job on your homework, you know, the whole science fair story did relate to this gal who was a very, very solid parent in the community, and much to my surprise, came up to me pretty much out of the blue and said, I'm an abductee, you know, I hear you're talking about that, let's go. Let me tell you my thing. In fact, I got a book about my story, and so even after she explained the whole thing, I said, can I see this book? And she sent the book to school with her kid, but, you know, it was in an envelope. Her kid didn't know that she had these experiences, but here was this guy, the same guy who investigated Betty and Barney Hill, Walter Webb, who had written books about that whole thing, and they're considered the most solid abductee case of all because they are the first, and therefore there was no copycat element to the Betty and Barney Hill story. Well, after that whole wave crashed on the beach, he picked up some other interesting things, and one of them was this other guy who was claiming an abductee event, and then he was corroborating it with this other gal locally in my area, and she didn't remember anything, but under hypnosis, she came up with the exact same story. It's a great, great story. So, I mean, that was one of the first chapters of the Edges of Science that really came together. And so I went back to the mom and I said, look, here's the chapter. Are you okay with me using this? And she swallowed hard at first, but after she read it, you know, she said, well, as long as you make these changes, and she even gave me pictures of the camp and things. It was so it's amazing how if you're willing to go there, sometimes you find this pent up reservoir of experiences that hasn't really reached the light of day. You know, every community is probably has some of these people who have really interesting events to share. You just have to winnow the grain from the chaff, as they say.
Now, I'm sure if anybody's tuning in right now and expecting to be hearing about nothing but Bigfoot, and we're talking about UFOs, they're probably confused, but...
Shame, shame.
Yes, the cover of your book, Edges of Science, there is a Bigfoot and there is a UFO, because as you talked about at the beginning of this interview, there's a lot of weird stuff about the Bigfoot phenomenon. And if you are one of those people that have decided it's an ape and there's nothing paranormal about this, you're disregarding a lot of information that may be valuable, such as
sure.
That.
Now, I would hasten to also add that, you know, even an ape that exists in the wilds of our contemporary world is paranormal by definition.
Sure.
Simply because, you know, the word paranormal just means that science really hasn't gotten the goods on it yet and may really not be equipped to do so. And so, you know, you could also say that pursuing Osama bin Laden is paranormal in that you cannot get scientific evidence on his whereabouts. And so instead, you sort of have to stay ahead of this doddering, you know, institution called science if you want to really be nimble and get the goods on an elusive and intelligent individual or set of individuals. So you realize that science is really not what you're doing. And that took me a long time to come to grips with because I was a science teacher, and here I am saying, no, science is all about it. But science is not nimble enough to sort of gather these, you know, fairly elusive scraps of data that help you assemble the picture. Science is more about proving things after the fact. I don't think there are too many experiments that were successful in the past that weren't built around a belief or a concept that the scientist already had. But first you have to develop the image or the concept of what's really going on, and then you design the experiment to verify or refute that. And the fact is that I came to realize that what I was really doing was a lot more like intelligence gathering than science, and I still applaud and encourage science. I do not disdain it. However, I'm moving so fast with the information I'm gathering that I sort of have to jump outside science and become more of a spy and just gather it all, and then maybe at some point in the future construct the experiment that'll satisfy the skeptical world. Meanwhile, I don't blame the skeptical world for being skeptical. I encourage it and teach it myself. I'm just out there on the edge, and so I sort of have to use a different set of tactics to move ahead. Things are happening fast.
I remember when Jacques Vallée's Passport to Magonia first came out. I don't remember. I wasn't born, but I remember the circumstances where this guy wrote this book, and at the time, there were all these science fiction movies, And all of these UFO researchers were convinced that these were just crafts from another planet.
Mm-hmm.
And Jacques Vallée was looking at it from a scientific perspective in the sense that, you know what, we don't know anything. And so let's look at all this data and let's look at history and let's try to figure out if there are any patterns and we'll see what we can deduce from this. And that's why I loved your book, because it is the same thing. It is a book that is going to make researchers, Bigfoot researchers, that have it set in their mind this is an animal. It's going to make them very uncomfortable. But as you noted, you've got to look at other, you've got to look at other theories, and you've got to take into account things that they like to dismiss, such as...
Sure. Well, not everybody does.
Not everybody.
I got buddies who are still on the, you know, ape view, and I don't overly... I don't make huge efforts to change or derail their thinking because, you know, I feel like, hey, you know, do your thing and I'll do mine, and then let's all just trade notes. No, everybody doesn't have to be doing the same thing. So, you know, there's the disdainful view of the paranormal people as the woo-hoos or the woo-woos, and I think Daniel Perez or Coleman started that thing as a sort of a disdainful thing, and so then the woo-woos came up with the apers, you know, to be equally disdainful of the opposing position. And you know, I guess I understand the human need to ridicule the opposition, but I find that, hey, let's all do our own thing. I encourage everybody to do it their way, but then let's also share whatever we got. And having been an aper or you know, scientific pursuer of Gigantopithecus blackii for a long time, and not having a lot to show and a lot of things to suggest the alternative view, you know, I was basically forced to at least tentatively embrace the opposing view or investigate it a little more. And it really boils down to one simple thing, and that is... it seems possible to communicate with them. And so, shoot, why shouldn't we experiment with that, even if it's delusional, and see what happens? While my buddy Cliff and, you know, whoever else he runs with pursues the physical explanations, and I'm going in a different one, then we still... check it out, you know, and compare. But what I'm finding is you can communicate. And that is the natural fallout from the suggestion that they're intelligent. And I'm certain that they're intelligent because, you know, my cameras were being disabled for so long. And so often, it was always varied. Sometimes they're pulled down. Sometimes the lens is covered with a leaf. And other times the trail to the camera is marked somewhat clearly with barriers that, you know, weren't put there by me or anybody else that I know of. But something knows that camera is there. So after seeing these kinds of things, I began to... you know, come to the suspicion that I was dealing with intelligent entities. And that's when I sort of made the next intellectual leap. And if there's anything that, you know, I'm proudest of as far as my whole pursuit of the whole thing is just that, well, I decided if they are intelligent, and I wasn't certain that they were, you know, when I say intelligent, I mean of equal or greater intelligence to us, then there must be communication. And therefore, how might that go? And so I decided, well, there has to be a telepathic element, simply because so many people who put themselves out there, even apers, you know, were coming back if they were open-minded and weren't squelching, you know, conflicting experiences. They said, no, something was talking to me out there. And so I got busy and designed some experiments that might, you know, bring that to the fore. And it does basically boil down to telepathy. To me, telepathy was strange at first, but the more I looked into it, the more I found that there's ample scientific basis for this phenomenon. You just have to read up and maybe even talk to people who have had these experiences, and when you do, you find that there is a remarkable similarity to what they find, to what they experience, I should say, and even to the messages that they receive. And it's really kind of comical because the messages mostly go away, you don't belong here, and mind your own business, that it's very standoffish, that they're not, you know, sort of eager to open a dialogue, but you can get some interesting tidbits.
Now, I don't remember the name of the two researchers, but you have a story in the book about how you're discussing some of this fringy sort of stuff, I guess, for lack of a better term.
And, no problem. Fringy is good.
That's right. And up walk two researchers.
Edgy. How about edgy?
Edgy. That's a good one. And as you're doing this, up walk two researchers, and you sort of were like, oh boy, these are two guys that are not going to want to hear this.
Oh, yeah. Chris Murphy and Tom Steinberg.
Okay, there you go.
The two Canadians, you know.
Yeah. But you decided, I'm going to just keep telling the story anyway.
Right.
And when you were done, they admitted, you know what? We have had some weird things occur.
Sure. Yeah.
Is this common?
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, is this common?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think it's possible that even among the flesh and blood Bigfoot researchers, a lot of them have experiences in their past that cause them, for some reason, to gravitate toward this, you know, paranormal pursuit. And you know, it's funny how the flesh and blood folk, who many of whom are my friends, you know, not to disparage them, but actually have some odd experience which cause them to gravitate toward the whole thing. And you know, they hate the word paranormal because it's supposed to be unscientific. But the funny thing is that paranormal is a word that the whole world uses to describe all of us. But only within the Bigfoot research community are there people who want to distinguish paranormal from, you know, flesh and blood or whatever you want to call it. But to the outside world, we're all paranormal. Sorry, fellas. So, you know, I think sometimes people are just trying too hard to live down that word. And it really is sort of just a label, and paranormal is one of those words that means a different thing to each person. So I've gotten past that, and I think sometimes distinctions and divisions are unhealthy, and I think that's where, as a Bigfoot research community, you know, the best thing we could do is just put all that stuff aside and say, hey, what do you got, and have conferences where people talk about, you know, both extremes and every other point in the middle. But anyway, so Chris Murphy and Tom Steinberg were at one of Ray Crow's gatherings, and this guy was telling me of the most paranormal thing imaginable, which wasn't necessarily even Bigfoot related, but how he stepped into a portal by accident and was staring at some other, you know, dimension or realm, and got the hell out of there with his, anyway. And so it is funny how at first I thought, oh God, I'm going to catch hell for this. But right, even these two guys who I thought of as fairly flesh and blood were like, oh no, we got stories too. We know. So yeah, I would say that there is a commonality among a lot of people even who see themselves as flesh and blood and scientific, and that is the really odd, hyper strange things that they have sometimes experienced. And some people are successful in plowing it under, and other people sort of you know, use it as a fulcrum to venture off in a slightly different investigative direction. That's me.
I just love the, I don't know if irony is the right word, but your average person on the street, if you told them, you know, I look for Bigfoot, they'd think, man, this guy's nuts. And then among the actual community, it's like, if there's a certain level of belief in Bigfoot that's okay.
Nutty, even within the nutty community.
Yeah, there's like a certain level of belief that's okay, but there's some stuff that's too crazy for them. It's kind of like, how can you be too crazy in when you're looking for Bigfoot, if you know what I mean?
Right. Like, so maybe the question is, Tom, is there anything that's too crazy for you?
That is a good question. What is too crazy for you?
Well, I guess on the one hand, people who say there's nothing strange about this world, that to me is crazy.
Sure.
But then the other thing is anything that doesn't sort of at least fit a pattern somewhere, you know, if there's one person who says they saw this, that, and the other thing, but nobody else talking the same smack, then I leave it on the vine. But when, you know, I got five or six or even three little post-it notes in the same part of the wall describing the same kind of thing, that's where I've learned that everybody doesn't have to do it. But if you want to be sort of nimble as a researcher and you have the wherewithal to do it, those are the things that are the most intriguing, the little patterns that maybe you spot all by yourself. By listening to these people with, you know, very weird experiences. And that's what Charles Fort was doing in the 30s. He was making file cards and filling shoe boxes full of these file cards on all these things. And he has a handful of hairy creature things, but he was mainly interested in, you know, weird rocks that are falling from the sky and people bursting into flames, you know, but a lot of it was, he was really looking into a lot of things that we would now throw into the UFO category. But even then, in the 30s, he was saying, man, there must be some connection, although he really didn't have any idea what. He was kind of the John Green of his day. He reported everything, but he didn't really stick his neck out and say, here's what seems to be going on. Here's the thread that sews it all together. So, you know, after reading enough of Charles Fort and these other guys and being in awe of what they did, considering their limited ability to gather information in a non-internet world, they were using the U.S. mail and stuff, and man, that's slow. But with a greatly accelerated ability to gather information and then put it all on sticky notes and put it on the wall and look at the patterns, and, you know, that's what CIA does. They look for patterns, and they got analysts, and that's their job. And so I'm trying to be this analyst, and I put it all together, and I go, oh God, this is it. So that's what, you know, Edges of Science is all about, is I'm trying to be the analyst and say, after you look at all the post-it notes on the wall, here's what it's all saying. And it seems to be saying, you know, in a nutshell, that they know each other, that the ET phenomenon, I don't like to use alien because, you know, the word is you know, incorrectly applied, but extraterrestrial, the ET phenomenon is in some form connected to the Sasquatch thing. They know each other. The Sasquatch are intelligent, and there's this crossover, and the crossover between the phenomenon is probably happening in subterranean hideouts, that is, underground, not the center of the earth necessarily, but maybe in the inside of, you know, mountains like Shasta and stuff, where people have been saying this stuff, San Francisco Peaks down in New Mexico, you know, on and on, Sedona.
Before I read your book, if somebody had said, and I had heard somebody say this, that they were in the woods and they saw a portal, I was like, okay,
Yeah, me too.
Here we go.
Yeah, I'm with you, brother.
Yeah, but you know what? When I read your book, okay, I still don't know if I believe that there are portals out there, but the one thing that I gathered from reading your book is it is not something... I don't want to say, okay, it's obviously rarely reported, but it is reported.
Mm-hmm.
There's more than like one report. There are many people who claim that they've seen these weird portals out in the woods. So,
and not to sound like a broken record, but Charles Fort, you know, was saying the same thing. They got these crazy things that happen with remarkable consistency if you just have access to the information. But you also got to shut up and listen to these people and not, you know, sit there with your little paradigm, your little glasses that see the world a certain color. I mean, you know, there's a tendency for Bigfoot researchers to go out there with their... fishing vest and camo pants and night vision goggles. And so that's what the paradigm represents to them. And it's like, okay, you'll get some stuff. But if you venture into murkier waters, it does seem that you can find some deeper patterns, but it is very troubling, and it does sort of threaten existing paradigms, and that's why I don't try to rock people's boat too much. If somebody doesn't want to hear it and they're into their thing, if Daniel Perez is really clung to the same view for just years and years, well, I'm not trying to change that. I am, in fact, glad that he's doing it that way. That way I don't have to. That frees me up to go a different direction and venture into the quicksand.
Describe what people see when they report that they came across a portal in the woods. And
well, the title of the chapter is Quicksilver Curtain, and the quicksilver, you know, the shimmering fluid mercury appearance. You know, if you've seen a bead of mercury sitting on a lab table back in the day when we broke the thermometer in science class, and here were these little shimmering beads with this surface that reflected, but like a curtain, you just see this shimmering presence in the otherwise ordinary looking landscape. That's the way it's described to me. I have never seen it personally, but I know people who, have not only seen it themselves, but are aware of others who corroborate. So, you know, this is one of these frontiers of information that I am reporting and just putting out there, and people can dismiss it. People can... think about it and then dismiss it, or they can investigate it themselves. But the problem is there isn't, you know, it doesn't, you can't just go find it. It has to find you. And so you're talking about phenomena that are really hard to gather information on. But if you just talk to enough people, there does seem to be a pattern. There's this shimmering curtain, and I think my take on it is that's one phenomena if you don't want to mess with. You don't know where you're going to end up if you dive into that thing. And there are those who even say that one of the roles of the Sasquatch in our world is to keep idiots from stumbling into these things and ending up somewhere where they don't want to be and can't get back from.
Now, there have been several individuals that have reported seeing a portal, but in your book, you have a story that is unlike anything I've ever heard.
Is that the Larry Kelm one where he stepped into it?
No, this is the sighting at the Mimi Mounds.
The Mima Mounds.
The Mima Mounds.
I think the town is called Mima.
Yes.
I keep hearing it both ways, but I actually was in Mima and I went to the Mini Mart and they said, it's Mima, not Mima. But I've heard people say it both ways. But yeah, the apparent Sasquatch wearing
cross-dresser,
mismatched person's clothing, Home Depot gloves, and
I read this three times. I just read it over and over because I am always, obviously we hear all sorts of reports about various things when you do a show like this, but I'm always intrigued by the fact that whether it's any aspect of the paranormal, there are always stories, and John Keel wrote about a lot of them. There are always some stories that are just so absurd.
Well, funny you should bring in John Keel, because I think he has the a potential answer to what is going on there, you know, and that is this witness at the Mima Mounds who witnessed this, you know, being in the most improbable mixture of clothing, and it was basically a very tall, hair-covered, you know, Sasquatch wearing this mishmash of men's and women's clothing to presumably conceal its identity. Well, Keel found that in some cases these weird events were indeed directed at him. These events that he was reporting, which are not the same as that but equally strange, seem to have one common theme, and that is they were trying to elicit his response and his showing up at the scene. It may have been directed at him. That is, when you study the phenomenon starts to study you. So in this case, what is going on with the Mima Mound things? And that is, that sighting, it was such an audacious statement that I didn't even want to put it in there. And that is, what if this witness witnessed something that was sort of meant to bring me there so that I, you know, investigated the Mima Mounds and maybe started to come up with some conclusions that, moved this whole thought ahead that, we're living in this petri dish in some ways called planet Earth. But we're also being sort of invited to join the galactic community, but it's something that has to happen gradually, and we just have to drag the public kicking and screaming into a different consciousness. But once you're sort of committed to trying to facilitate that, things start coming your way. To use the baseball player analogy, these fat pitches start being thrown at you, but as the batter knows, you can have a fat pitch, but if you stand there with the bat on your shoulder, it's a strike. But if you use your bat, you get a home run out of it, and so the idea is, here are these opportunities for you, the researcher, to really move ahead, but you have to recognize that something was just thrown your way, and you got to respond to it. You have to take action, or it's going to whiz by, and you missed the chance. So as a researcher, I think if you're really on the edge, you sort of have to be, as I said before, nimble enough to recognize these opportunities, and don't stand there wondering where the hell it came from, or was that really directed at me, or was it just, am I making this stuff up? Am I too egocentric for my own damn good? You know, you could easily get bogged down in those thoughts, but instead you just have to go, screw it. I'm going to just go with this and see where it takes you. And that's where some of the most interesting revelations, I think, come from.
Well, let's go back to the beginning a little bit here. When you were doing the search for a flesh and blood creature, and you were doing the camera traps and all of the usual Bigfoot hunting deals.
Blaster in a backpack, ready to cast tracks.
Yep. And as you mentioned, all sorts of mysterious things happen. If you talk to somebody on the street and you said, I got these trail cams out, and for some reason, maybe trail cams is the wrong term, but basically, whenever you try to take a photograph, the trail cams. Well, I mean, what I was going to say was trail cams just stopped working, or maybe, you know, you saw the Bigfoot and you went to take the photo, and like the whole roll of film back when people had rolls of film. I mean, the whole thing was ruined, and you know, your average person would say, "Well, how convenient."
Or you're just a dumbass. That's
sure.
the problem, Tom.
Exactly.
You're a dumb shit.
Exactly. But the other way that you could look at it is, what a weird coincidence. Mm-hmm. Why Why do we never get anything on a trail cam? Why does the trail cam break? Why is something always in front of the trail cam? Why does the camera always take a blurry photo?
You only realize that when you open yourself up and talk to other people. If you're just doing your own thing and keeping it secret from everybody else because you're going to get the glory someday because you think you got it figured out, then you never get anywhere. But once you communicate with other people and they start describing exact same things that you experience, that's when it really puts the chill in you and you realize that, it's an equally plausible possibility that in some form I'm being worked. And the only way to understand it is to open up and talk to other people and share your biggest secrets with them, and then you find out that they have incredibly similar experiences and they have no way to explain them either.
Now, before you got into looking at alternate explanations for this, let's say that you heard of a trackway. And the trackway goes whatever. Let's say you find 50 casts or whatever. And all of a sudden, in the middle of whatever, they just stop. And there's nowhere for them to go. There's no... I mean, even if they were hoaxed, where did the guy go that had these things on his feet?
Well, that did happen back in the 90s when I was as flesh and blood as anybody ever was.
What did you
and
think?
And we just assumed that they were backing up in their own tracks.
I see.
And you know, you could do that. And there are grizzly bear researchers who say that even grizzly bear make efforts to conceal their tracks, that a dang bear is that smart. Because there's more grizzly bears in Colorado than anybody realizes, but they've adapted their, modus operandi so that they confine their activities to very small areas and very remote drainages. But once they venture outside that, they understand that their tracks are a complete giveaway, and so on and so forth. So these are bear researchers finding this. These aren't Bigfoot people. And so then if you apply the same thing to Bigfoot, it's like, okay, well, then there's a plausible explanation for how the tracks could end. But in other cases, you find like a single track in the middle of nowhere, or let's just say no other tracks around it, and one right there on this molehill of fresh earth that could have easily been avoided, and that's the only track. And, after seeing that one a few times, then you start to realize, okay, clearly there is another option here, and that is that track is a calling card, that we're dealing with something that is eminently in control of the evidence of its whereabouts, but it'll sometimes, throw you a bone. It'll leave a indication of its presence if it wants to sort of acknowledge you. And once you sort of put away the guns and even the cameras and try to be more feng shui, interestingly, you start getting more of that. You start getting, indications that they're throwing you a bone. They're acknowledging your presence and leaving you things. But at the very least, it comes back to the old, they're way smarter than just this shambling creature who's leaving tracks unaware of its, unaware of the tracks that it's leaving. When it leaves tracks, it's because it wants to, and it's essentially the Sasquatch Vistaprint calling card,
Now, to play devil's advocate, how do we know when those bear tracks stop that the bear didn't vanish or get taken up by a UFO?
But, so there's your research, all right?
That's right. That's going to be my calling card.
We can't all do it all. And I'll meet you at the brew pub, and you tell me what you're getting.
That's right.
And that's how we do it.
Now, at the beginning here, we very quickly just kind of brushed over you were a flesh and blood guy, and then weird things happened, and you went in a different direction. Was there, one day where it all of a sudden was just like, this is too weird?
No,
this is the one thing that tipped me over the edge.
One thing, you know, scientifically holds water. It's only when you start to see a pattern to these things, and then other people chime in with similar patterns. So, you know, it's like Sasquatch encounters in the first place. Most Sasquatch encounters, they only later realize what happened. They get the shit scared out of them by some smell, some noise, some rock that comes flying, some something. And then later they talk to other people and they realize what really happened. And then for the first time do they really understand. But it's all happening too fast and too much by surprise to really get it when it's happening. And the same is definitely true with, you know, any of the paranormal stuff. You know, I remember a time when I tried to take a picture randomly in one direction with my digital camera, and it wouldn't work. And then I looked at my watch, and my watch stopped. And then I turned around and faced the other way, and my camera worked. And I took a picture, and I looked at my watch, and it was working. And then I turned back around to the first direction, and the camera wouldn't work, and the watch and I'm like, what the hell? But even then, I just thought, you know, whatever. But then when you read, and then you all of a sudden, so one day you it all fits, and you go, oh my God, that's exactly what the crop circle people report. And then that's when, you know, the hair stands up on the back of your head, and retroactively you realize that there was one of the defining moments of your experience with the subject, but you are seldom astute enough to recognize it as it's happening.
You know, one of the best parts of the book and one of the best parts of the presentation that you gave at the Sasquatch Summit was when you were talking about David Politis, and you essentially, I was sitting there watching the presentation, and you brought up Politis's name, and then I cannot remember what you said, but it was something along the lines of, you called and asked Politis something, and his response was like, the green ones, or something really, really, really weird. And I was almost blown backward off my chair, because I've heard a million David Politis interviews. I've interviewed him on the show. David Politis will not ever say what he thinks is causing these people to disappear. And if you want to know one of David's ideas, you got to read Tom's book right here, because you actually write about it. And I was like, finally, somebody is telling me what Politis actually thinks here. Who are the green ones?
I was faced with this one missing person case, which really fit the pattern that he had discovered. And he really is a pioneer. I mean, what an amazing body of work he's put together. And controversial as hell, and he's very stalwart. So I really admire the guy's literary prolificness, if that's a word. He really puts it together, but he doesn't want to speculate too much, if at all, on what's going on, because he feels like it might color the data that would then come his way in the future, which is not that different than John Green. You know, John Green, for all his books, really didn't do much speculating about what was really going on. He was a reporter, and that's what reporters do. And so Politis is kind of that way, and, you know, Charles Fort was too back in the 30s. So their approach has perfect validity. However, you know, when I was trying to reconcile this one event, I said, come on, Dave, you know, you do all this work. What the hell's going on? And he said, well, I don't speculate. And, you know, that was it. But that's when at least I didn't give it up. I emailed him back one more time and say, well, for God's sake, you know, just stick your neck out here and tell me. And he said, all right, you know, there's four options. There's ETs, there's Sasquatch, there's mass murderer loose on public lands, and there's reptilians. Well, I sort of wrote him back and said, well, you know, begging your pardon, but aren't reptilians just one type of ET? Why distinguish between the two? And, you know, no answer. But I think really what's going on, none
he
of
said
is
too
really
much
coming out of Dave's mind. This is what the witnesses are saying to him. But there are certain things he's holding back on because he doesn't want to sort of taint his whole data source with too much speculation. But certainly some of the people he's talking to have speculated about what's going on, and he's aware of that, and he knows that it fits into three or four categories depending on how you distinguish.
Now, earlier you were talking about telepathy, and if you haven't heard this before, again, you're probably thinking this is insanity, but there are a lot of Bigfoot folks that have seen Bigfoot, and they'll tell you all about their Bigfoot experience, but they don't like to tell you about the telepathy thing.
Mm.
And it is something that many of them, when for whatever reason, maybe they come upon somebody else who's had the same experience, or they're pushed on it or whatever, they will admit that this happens. It's not as rare as people think. It's just something, they think that that's too crazy.
Of course it is, because, you know, if you're hearing voices, then you're certified.
Yes.
And that is essentially what's going on. These people are hearing voices. And so I don't blame anybody for, you know, totally playing that down. I'm in awe of the fact that there are people who are willing to open up because they're taking such a risk. But I have found that if you, at least are willing to, you know, not necessarily validate their experience, but at least, validate them as people to where they're not afraid to tell you what really happened. And I find that really starts by what I find is I tell people several different experiences that people have had variously, and then I'll let them figure out which of those experiences they want to ascribe to, and that there are certain ones who, you know, when I say there are these people who have, you know, are hearing words and hearing statements and hearing, ideas or messages being sent, that some people will leave that on the vine, and other people will say, oh my God, I get that too. I wasn't going to tell you that because I didn't want you to think I was crazy. So, a completely understandable human tendency to not want to go there. And some of the people are crazy. You know, people with mercury poisoning and stuff do have such experiences that do emanate from within their mind, and it is not external. But when you have a kid and a female who live in the outskirts, you know, the edges of wild areas, who don't necessarily have any other reasons to doubt, then you listen to what they say and look for the potential pattern behind those. And when you find it, then you have something that you keep, that you don't throw away, and that might actually be pointing toward a real phenomenon.
And as you note, it's not like creatures in the woods and hearing voices telling you things in the woods is a new phenomenon. It is as old as history.
It is, but it really represents several potential, manifestations.
Sure, yeah.
And you got to sort that out. And that is the realm of the paranormal researcher. And so, you know what? As hobbies go, I don't think you can do any better.
No.
I used to do model railroads and kayaking, and, I still do those things. But of all the things that I found, what a mental challenge And it really behooves you to just read, to do your homework, and to just apply rigorous thought to the whole thing. And I will tell you one more thing that is mentioned in sort of the back of the book, but only in passing, and that is if you really want to sort of make these intellectual leaps, not that anything I've ever done is necessarily that, but some of my best work has come when I am trying to resolve these questions, and then I take a long walk in the woods at night. And boy, all of a sudden, everything comes into this razor-sharp focus sometimes. And when it does, I've learned, pull out a pad and write down what's coming your way. And it's maybe akin to hearing voices. It's more like hearing ideas. And it may be your own mind. I don't care whether it comes from within or without. I just care about the profundity of the information. Does it hold water? Does it make sense to other people? Once I put it in print and circulate it, you know, I'm always a little bit uncertain about the ideas once they occur to me and me alone. But when I put it out there, and other people say, "Oh no, 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 that resonates. That's it. That makes sense." And then the historical element also supports that. Then I think that's the best you can do.
Final question here. Friday tomorrow, I presume you're going to go teach. Are you able to still stay incognito? Or at this stage, are you sort of well-known?
Oh, no. I'm not only well-known, but I'm a laughing stock, but in a good way, you know, because, you know, I got better jokes than anybody. You know, the fun of it all is to just, you know, make every joke, beat everybody to the joke. I'm not sensitive about my interests, and I don't, you know, disdain humor. I exploit it. So, you know, my line is my Bigfoot jokes are better than your Bigfoot jokes. Go ahead, make a Bigfoot joke. You know, you can't ignore the humor. And the other thing is, if you're dealing with an intelligent set of beings, then humor is the hallmark of intelligence. And one thing I've experienced in the Bigfoot research realm is that every once in a while you get worked in a way that utterly speaks of sense of humor, you know, at your expense.
Oh yeah.
So I think that's beautiful, and that's where, again, I sort of realize that, oh my God, if they can play that trick on me, if I can beat a tree 100 miles away and then come home and hear the same pattern, then I'm dealing with something that is intelligent enough to have a sense of humor that is as good or better than mine.
Tom Powell, T-H-O-M, Tom Powell, Edges of Science.
It's the Welsh spelling. That's Tom. That's right. The Welsh dialect has lots of silent consonants.
That's right. And Edges of Science is the book. It's an awesome book if you love this topic. And it is not your only one, so I want to give you an opportunity here to plug everything else you've got, your blog, and whatever you'd like to get out to the world.
Well, the Tom Squatch is just where, you know, I ramble on, as everybody does in the blogosphere. The key is T-H-O-M, Squatch, but that'll show up. You know, Edges of Science is the third one. The locals, I was pretty much as flesh and blood as the next guy, although some of the stuff was leading me in the other direction. And then as I moved to the country and found these incredible stories, I wove about six or eight people's different experiences into one fictional character or set of characters, and that's the middle of the three. It's a novel, and it's called Shady Neighbors. In a way, that's my favorite one because it tells it all through a humorous story. It isn't so didactic and scientific. It's just a story, but it certainly hints at, you know, pretty much all of the stuff we've talked about tonight by way of a little bit of a clever story.
That's Tom Squatch, T-H-O-M Squatch, if you want to find the blog. And everything that you need is up at Amazon.com. Make sure you check out the book, Edges of Science. And are you going to do the Sasquatch Summit next year?
Yeah, I think he's got me on there for one more year. I don't want to get stale. Boy, it's hard to go in there and come up with new stuff each time. But every time I go in there, I recognize the same faces, so I don't dare do the same talk twice.
It was big this year.
Yeah, he does a fantastic job. Johnny is the guy in the Western United States. Only Mark DeWorth in the East packs a bigger house.
So check it out, everybody. And Tom, I want to thank you so much for doing the show today. And hopefully one of these days we could do it again. I could ask 1,000 more questions. But
I know. You could go on and on, but I think an hour is enough.
That's right.
The best time is in a brew pub, you know, with a pint of IPA. That's how you talk about Sasquatch.
That's right. Check it out, everybody. And Tom, I want to thank you so much. And
right.
We'll be back in just a moment, everybody.
Hey.
After Dark Radio, Dark Matter.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much. Dark Matter,
right.
Digital Network. We are back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here. After Dark Radio, Dark Matter Digital Network. Every Sunday night, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern. Also available at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. And I updated the website. I added some information that I just realized wasn't even up there. How do you contact me? How do you contact anybody? I've added all of that to the website. My email address, Brian, B-R-Y-A-N. At AfterDarkRadioShow.com. What could be easier? Brian at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. If you have mailbag questions, mailbag statements, mailbag stories, that is the address. We've got the info for Carl Stern up there as well if you want to email him. Kenneth Nita, who is our producer, you can check that out. Our other producer, Andrew Lutsky, is also the man behind the Facebook page. Facebook.com/AfterDarkRadioShow. If you want to contact him, I've got the information on the Facebook page up there as well. So make sure you head up there and grab all of that. And this from Kevin in the mailbag. Not sure exactly how old I was, but I have a couple of memories from around 1 to 2 years old. In one, I'm standing in my crib, and my mom is talking about a broken toy of mine as she cleans the room. She says, quote, "Maybe lightning came in the window and broke it," in a flippant manner. This scared me because I thought if lightning could break one of my toys, it could hurt me. In another, my parents and grandma were leaning over me, telling me that mom and dad are leaving to take my sister to the ice capades, and that grandma will be babysitting for the day. I remembered wondering if I couldn't go with them as well. When I told my parents about this, they were stunned because I had been just a baby at the time. They were taking my older sister out because they didn't want her to feel slighted because of all the attention I had been getting as the new baby. It's weird to think at that young age, we are so aware of what's going on, but we seldom remember any of it. My fiancé and I joke that these memories are probably where a lot of my anxiety comes from. I have a few other memories, but I believe I was older than 2 when asking my parents about them. I'm almost 38 years old now. So, of course, this is on the ongoing deal we've been doing regarding memories before the age of 1 or 2, because science claims you can't have them, yet we've had several people emailing the show saying, no, in fact, I have memories from that age. So if you have memories, you're welcome to send them to me, Brian@AfterDarkRadioShow.com. And really, anything that is on your mind, I love stories. If you believe you have seen something that you shouldn't have seen, Bigfoot, UFOs, ghosts, etc., send those to me, Brian@AfterDarkRadioShow.com. And with that, everybody, we are out of time today. I want to thank Tom Powell, obviously, for being on the show. I want to thank all of you for listening. Don't forget, tonight is a doubleheader. Do not switch that dial. As soon as this show goes off the air, Carl Stern's Dragon King Dark is going to be airing on the Dark Matter Digital Network. He's going to be talking the legend of Aunt Jenny Johnson. It's going to be a great show, so make sure you check that out. This show will replay free all week as a downloadable MP3 at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. Carl Stern's show is going to be airing at AfterDarkRadioShow.com as well. We got a great column up right now by Mark Howes. If you want to get involved with the website, drop me an email as well, Brian@AfterDarkRadioShow.com. And we will be back next week with a brand new show. Thanks, as always, to Keith Rowland, everybody at the Dark Matter Digital Network, and all of you. We will talk to you again next time. After Dark Radio, here on the Dark Matter Digital Network.
said I should.